This is the final session of the fall quarter Applying Media Resources workshop. I wanted to kind of wrap up on this note about long-term strategies, okay? So if you still have your packet, right?
Yes.
Okay, so if we look at the handout, what I'm going to focus on today are steps 4 and 5.
Okay.
And step 4 is all about becoming a good interviewee. Right. And step 5 is more directly on developing a media strategy or routine. And these two steps actually fold together quite a lot. And one is more the practice of a tactic, right, a particular skill. But it melds very well with developing a strategy and having this, you know, being a good interviewee be one of the things in your toolbox that you can use in order to develop good and effective relationships with all different kinds of media. Basically, to start out, I just wanted to go over the steps in step 4, becoming a good interviewee. And this can be really difficult for people, right? Because interviews are not really like normal conversations in that you are trying to, especially if you are being interviewed as a representative of your organization or as a representative of a particular cause, that you want to advocate, you're representing a particular point of view, a particular message, a particular sort of institution, and you want to convey information, right? That's the main function of being an interviewee. And it's not just sort of answering the reporter's questions. It's not sort of a passive act, even though it can seem like one. You have to be an active interviewee. That's what it means to be a good interviewee. Okay. The first thing that we do when we are active and good interviewees is to keep things simple and interesting, right? This is because you want to convey your message, right, the substance of it, the information in it as clearly as possible, as quickly as possible, and also as quotably as possible, right? And the quotability is not just about it's not just about spin, it's not just about messaging, but it's also about making sure that your words get into the article or radio program or television show that you are trying to, you know, represent your organization to, right? Because you can say all sorts of things, all sorts of very important things that contain important information about what you're doing, but unless you say them in a way that is concise enough, clear enough, simple enough for the reporter to be able to lift phrases or perhaps even sentences from what you've said, you have less direct influence on what's getting reported, right? So if you have a lot of information that you have conveyed to this person, but it's very scattered, you know, the reporter has to do more work in terms of interpretation and representation of you, right, and your organization and your cause, and may, you know, even with the best intention, make mistakes, right, you know, or may misrepresent you because they have misunderstood, or, you know, all sort of manner of things. It's just easier for them and for you, and more effective for you, if you're able to speak in a way that is quotable, right? Now, that doesn't mean that everything you say should be a soundbite. It shouldn't. Obviously, that should not be the case, because then you sound unnatural and disingenuous, and also you can't convey very much information, you know, in that way. But let's get down to sort of brass tacks and go over sort of step by step what becoming a good interviewee entails, right? So the first thing is that you want to stick to one or two main themes or messages. This is the same for cultural groups that are trying to publicize an event, right? So for instance, a festival or a celebration or an educational or art opening, right? Mm-hmm. Or for advocacy groups, right? You want to have one or two themes or messages that you're emphasizing during the course of the interview, right? So the reporter or journalist or whatever is going to be asking questions, and you want to answer their questions, but during the course of answering their questions, it's important to understand that in your content, you want to convey what you want them to know, not just what they have asked. So, for instance, share with us the name of your organization.
The name of my organization is Healing Our Nation Network.
Okay. So Healing Our Nation Network, and what events are you doing? What's coming up?
Okay. What's coming up, we're planning a workshop on prejudice, racism, and internalized depression the 1st of January 2006 in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, okay, great. So you got one coming up very quickly. So if I am a reporter from the Hyde Park Herald, say, or the Daily Southtown, whatever, and I want to know, you know, what your event is about, say, I say, okay, so what will you be doing at the workshop on January 1st, 2006?
It will be an introductory workshop where we will explain to the audience or to the participants exactly how many workshops they will be and what each subject matter of each workshop will entail.
Okay. And what is the subject matter of the workshop?
Prejudice.
Prejudice. And can you tell me what prejudice means?
Okay, now is this when I say, do I say Healing Our Nation believes that prejudice is an emotional commitment to ignorance? Now I'm asking you that.
That's great.
Do I say that? Because then I wrote down, you say my words, because it's such an emotionally charged subject that we're kind of trained like to follow a script.
That's the way it should be. Yeah.
Okay, because then, you know, you can kind of go off like you probably see me do something. So that's why I said, should I say, you know, always refer to, you know, that's what the organization says, or will somebody catch me and say, well, what do you think?
Well, sure. I mean, you can never tell. I mean, someone could ask, you know, well, what do you think personally? Or what are your personal experiences with prejudice, right? These are all legitimate questions that can be asked of you, and you have to be able to respond to them. So, for instance, if I were to personalize it in that way, how would you respond? If I were to say, okay, that's what Healing Our Nation thinks, but what do you think? Like, how would you define prejudice? In fact, that might have been the way I asked the question in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you have a choice. You can respond with the same words or different.
Personally, I would say my definition, my personal definition of prejudice is, even if we have to get as elementary as talking about children and broccoli, the way that we frown at vegetables,
okay,
the way that they're cooked, and we say we don't like that,
mm-hmm,
and we haven't even tried it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think that either one is great, like, but you have to be aware that, I mean, when you, both are wonderful. So the first one is concise, right? And sort of like easy to lift, like sort of wholeheartedly. It's, you know, an emotional commitment to ignorance. Easy peasy, like that is completely quotable. The second one is more of a story and a narrative, but mm-hmm, it's great if, you know, the focus of the story is to put a personal face on or to tell a story about the advocates, right, the people who are, you know, running the workshop. And you have a complete narrative, right? You don't end with, I don't know, right? Or you don't sort of trail off at the end of the sentence. These are things that are definite mistakes in interviews to say, you know, not to say I don't know and then give your reasons. That's actually very smart if you actually don't know, right?
Yeah.
But to say, you know, someone asks a question, an admittedly hard question, right? Like, what is prejudice, right? What does prejudice mean to you? And when you're a good interviewee and you've had time to prepare, you should try to have answers to questions like that, even hard questions. And if you don't have personal answers, it's nice to be able to follow a script of your organization.
Then right? I could inject a story, which I have a story, rather than talk about the vegetables.
Yeah, or mm-hmm, you could talk about the vegetables. The thing is that you gave a nice, easy to understand, brief narrative, mm-hmm, right? And that's also a really good part of being a good interviewee. But let's go on and to brass tacks. So you have a message, you know what your sort of main theme is, right? And that's good. Many organizations, especially small cultural and arts organizations, forget how important it is to have a message or a theme to stick to, right? They sort of, and this is natural, right? Do free form talking, you know, extemporaneous speech that's not necessarily unified in any way, you know, to a particular topic or theme. You know, so for instance, if it's a young magazine or something like that that's doing race and politics issues, you know, a person who has never had any, you know, training in interviewing might ramble, right, for several minutes about, you know, what they think is important and why it might be important, and, you know, have speech that is interrupted a lot by non sequiturs or stories that don't go anywhere or don't seem to relate back to. And these things, it's, you know, might seem normal in conversation and are normal in conversation, but are not great in interviews, especially when you're representing your organization. Okay, so after sticking to one or two main messages or themes, it's important also to repeat, right? Even in the course of a short interview, don't be afraid to repeat your message. Not like a broken record, and try not to, you know, if a reporter asks you, for instance, in your case, what does prejudice mean to you, or what does prejudice mean, you know, and you give your answer, and then the reporter asks an entirely different question, like, I don't know, an entirely different question, like, what are people's responses to their workshop training in your experience, right? Mm-hmm. You know, entirely different question. Mm-hmm. Don't feel like you have to interweave, you know, script from what you said before into a question like that. Otherwise, you sound kind of strange and not credible and, you know, like you're not interacting naturally with the reporter, right? So having a script doesn't mean that you don't have to pay attention to what the reporter is saying, or that you don't have to answer their questions directly, right? There are things about, you know, sort of cues about interaction that makes you seem credible, right, and authorized in a way that is really important. And part of that is paying attention and answering the questions that are asked. And that's why it's really important to have an overarching message or theme for your organization or event, right, that you know of beforehand, and to prepare as much as possible for interviews. Okay. Right. So we also, the third step, right, the third, you know, skill or tactic is craft a couple of sound bites in advance, right? Some questions that are you're pretty sure you're going to be asked. So, for instance, healing our nation obviously might be asked, what does that mean to you? You know, what is prejudice? What are the workshops supposed to do? Like, these are questions that anyone might ask. And they're questions that it's important to have thought about with your organization beforehand, right? Okay. So that you can have at least sketches of answers, right? Outlines that make it easier for you to respond to reporters or people that you're representing yourself to, okay? Okay, so here's an example in the case of sound bites, right? The difference between a sound bite and something that is not. So, for example, one could say, Advocates for Diversity in Education is here today to remind our community that all people have a right to a good education, right? Okay. Simple, to the point, one sentence. A sound bite can also be less than a sentence, right? So, but this is just an example. While this other sentence, right, or set of sentences is not a soundbite, although it conveys useful information, okay? That is, I am here representing Advocates for Diversity in Education, and we are concerned about the state of education in Illinois. Our research shows that many children do not have adequate access to quality education that many of us would expect, right? So this is sort of the beginning of a speech, more like, right? Or anyway, it has a lot more details in it, which is good, and it's something that one should be prepared for. But if you're, you know, depending on the length of the interview, the time that you're trying to fill, the time that you have to drive your point home, may not be the best thing. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't mean that in an interview you should speak only in sound bites, right? But it is important to include a few, especially around key themes, messages, or issues, right? In order to have as much direct influence, right, or potential direct influence on media coverage as you can. Okay. Along with the whole sound bites thing, the next concrete skill or step is to speak briefly, speak clearly, and speak simply, right? Often when we do work, nonprofit work in any field, right, education, arts, every field has its own jargon, its own acronyms, you know, its own way of speaking, right, which might not be immediately intelligible to a layperson.
Right.
But when you're being interviewed, right, or talking to a different, you know, a group of people that's not necessarily your core audience, you have to remember to speak clearly and simply in a way that, you know, anybody, everybody can understand, you know, any interested person. And to really avoid jargon. Jargon turns people off more quickly than almost anything, okay. Right? Okay, the next sort of concrete skill is to assert the point, right? Whatever point you're trying to make, and to make suggestions. People are often very afraid to do this in interviews, right? Because we think of it as a passive process. The reporter asks you questions and you answer them. That's what an interview is. But that's not what an interview is, right? It's a two-way street. And the interviewee has a role, an active role that they can play as well, right? They can, you know, change the questions around, right? You can answer the kind of question that you want to be asked in a certain way, right? Or give the information that you think that the person should have that they may not have asked about through ignorance or through, you know, not being familiar with your issue or whatever, right? So, and the other thing you can do is to actually make arguments, right, during the course of the interview. And people are often sort of afraid to do that unless they've been asked, what's your argument for, you know, the importance of having to attend a Heal Our Nation workshop, right? People forget that you can make an argument, you can advocate for your group, your event, whatever, in the course of a normal interview where you may not be asked that question, okay? So, more on that. So, during or after an interview, you can also follow up. You can be sure to tell the reporter which of your points you think, right, is most important, right? Otherwise, they only have their own, you know, their own stuff to choose from, right. Whatever they think. And that's right, right? That's right for them to do. They select what's most important unless you've provided them with that information. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is particularly important when you're speaking about an issue that might be controversial or sensitive, right? Like racism, right? Mm-hmm. Or sexism or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. Or the event that you're holding might be controversial. Like, for instance, an art opening that, you know, has certain parts of the collection that there's been controversy about or something like that. Yes, so that's really important, is to make sure that the reporter knows or whoever's covering your story knows which part is most important to you. The second thing is, especially on controversial topics, is to, you might suggest, right, questions that the reporter might ask the other side, right, or sides, right? So as we know, journalists often, right, journalists have an ethic of balance, right? They like to be able to have access to and report on both sides, right, or many sides of a story. And if whatever you're doing, right, or advocating for is controversial and there is some other side, right, that they may contact, then you might want to suggest questions, you know, that they might ask. Not in terms of telling them how to do their job, but in terms of saying something like, well, people who don't think that diversity workshops are necessary, I always wonder, you know, how they think that people will be able to or learn to relate to one another if they don't have that kind of training, you know? And that's what we do. And that's, you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You sort of work those suggestions into what you say, right? And in this way, you're able to convey information honestly, right? Clearly and simply, but you leave less up to the interpretation of the person who's covering your event, your story, your organization. Because in general, reporters are interested, busy generalists, right? They don't necessarily have a personal stake in what you're doing. Right. They don't necessarily, you know, and even if they do, they may not be able to convey it, right? Mm-hmm. And you cut down on that a little bit by doing what we have discussed in other sessions, which is knowing who you're talking to, right? Mm-hmm. Being a good media consumer and knowing who the journalists are you're working with, the journals that they work for, or the shows, right, that they work for, you know, in broadcast media. Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are the two things about asserting the point and making suggestions. And the last thing is to not be afraid to say you don't know, if you don't know, right? Don't make things up. There is nothing more credibility shattering than to pull out a fake statistic. Mm-hmm. That is number one no-no. Never do that, right? Okay. This is easily detectable by reporters and readers, right? Even if the reporter doesn't catch it, readers will catch it. And it just destroys the credibility of whatever else you said, even if you said many things that are important and accurate and correct. Right? Okay. But not only with statistics and things that are easily verifiable, but also with, you know, in any kind of general factual information, if you don't know, say so, and explain why you don't know, mm-hmm. right? And that's usually the most sort of intelligent way to approach something like that. Okay, so those are the steps, right, in the toolkit of in the toolbox of being an interviewee. And they make a big difference. And like so many of the other things that we've talked about, such as, cold calling or making initial contact with press, they require practice, right? Mm-hmm. But that's really all they require, right? You don't have to necessarily be a public relations genius, right, to be a good interviewee. You just have to sort of, you know, put these tips into practice. Okay?
Okay.
So what I wanted us to do is just take a few minutes to do a little exercise, an interviewing exercise, you know, just take about 10 minutes to do that. And then we'll move on to developing a media strategy and routine. And really talking about how you create a comprehensive and regular media routine, because that's when it's going to work best for you, right? Okay. Is when it's a sort of regular part of what your organization does, along with whatever cultural arts or advocacy work your organization does as well. Okay? So for the interviewing exercise, what I want us to do is take a few minutes. And both of us are going to play the role of both the interviewer and the interviewee.
Okay.
And we can go, either one can go first. Which one would you like to be first? Which role would you like to play?
Oh, I guess I want to be the interviewee.
Okay, the interviewee first. And what will be our topic of interviewing that we're interviewing about?
Do we stick with my same topic, or do we pick something else for a little variety?
Whatever you like. I mean, we can really work through your topic. That, I think, is fine. It's a great issue mm-hmm. in terms of, it's difficult, right? It's a difficult issue to talk about. It's sensitive, could be controversial, you know, like it's a great issue, so we can do mm-hmm. that if you want.
I want to talk about it.
Okay. So we'll be talking about the Healing Our Nation conference in January 1st, 2006.
Yes.
So, first you're going to be the interviewee, okay? And we're going to try to put into practice some of the things we've talked about thus far, right?
Okay.
So, I'm going to put on the reporter hat. Okay. Here I am. Okay. So, I've read a little bit about Healing Our Nation and what your organization is and what it does. And I know that you all are having a workshop, a community workshop, coming up on January 1st, 2006. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what Healing Our Nation's mission is.
Okay. The mission of Healing Our Nation Network is to organize citizens on a local and a national level to overcome personal and institutionalized prejudice through education.
Okay. And what do you mean by personal and institutionalized prejudice?
First of all of us possess some type of personal prejudice. And then there's a level of institutionalized prejudice that is experienced at schools, at churches, at your job, those type of things.
Okay. But I still don't get a sense of what you think prejudice means.
All right. May I tell you a short story?
Sure.
Okay. There's a factory on the southeast side of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
This is in a neighborhood that is mostly Latino, ethnically a Latino neighborhood. It's my understanding for some time there was a lot of controversy about the Latino groups or the members of the Latino group being late for work. One of the bosses who hired a Latina made a comment to her that he was so very proud to have her working for him because she was never late like them. Despite the fact that the employer was well aware that, let's say, Maria was a good worker, he still exhibited a certain amount of an emotional commitment to ignorance, because while he removed Maria from her group as being something different, he still had the same prejudicial feelings that just she was different and the rest were just the same.
Okay. So how do you think that people go about ending their commitment to ignorance, as you phrase it?
Oh, through workshops like ours, where different demographic groups sit down and talk to one another, discuss personal problems, mm-hmm. Discuss the race issues, mm-hmm. segregation, why we're segregated. We look at what's happening, how we live, where we live, where we go to school, the churches that we go to, how we as a community, as a society, separate ourselves from one another, and why we do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I just have one more question from you, or two more questions. One, have you ever run a workshop like this before? I mean, has the organization ever run a workshop like this before?
Oh, yes, we have. Many, many.
And have you found them to be successful?
Yes, we have.
And how do you measure that success?
Oh, this is the same thing that I wrote down here for you. We measure the success based on surveys that we send out, let's say, 6 weeks after a workshop has concluded. We retain and we ask permission of the members if we may mail them a survey and if they would answer the survey. And how we measure it depends on when you first come into the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
You're given a questionnaire and you don't sign your name or anything. And you just answer certain questions that raise the emotional thermostat,
mm-hmm.
and you turn these in. You know what you responded to on a piece of paper, but we don't really want to know your name.
Sure.
And then at the end, then we ask you if you'd be willing to fill out a survey and return it. And then when the surveys are returned, we can start to gauge by the answers. Mm-hmm. We can also gauge by the response for the people that want to sign up for the next series of the workshops. If we're gathering interest, if we're making momentum, if people are responding in a positive way or saying, well, you know, I never thought about it that way. I've never been exposed to that person.
Mm-hmm.
I use that same old cliche all the time without thinking that it's insensitive, that it would hurt someone else. So right now, that's how we're measuring success.
Okay, great. Great. You're a fantastic interviewee. I just want to put that out there. So you did a lot of the things that we talked about doing, right? You kept things sort of short and to the point. You were also extremely engaging. You talked in plain language. You told a story, but it was short and concise enough so that it didn't feel rambling or off topic.
I didn't feel good about it, though. I didn't feel good about it when I was saying it to you. Because I was stumbling,
right?
And because I didn't seem to be able to say the employer's ethnic group like I thought maybe I should. I didn't know how to say that because I'm tiptoeing. Because I'm trying to be sensitive, but then at the same time I want to say it clear and concise, and that's kind of hard hitting sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
To say, well, a European employer who always used stereotypes and prejudices made remarks, or the company, it was the company policy, or the company believed that in hiring Latino Americans that they would always be late. This was their suspicion. So there I go again with what I guess I had said several classes before, or the first class, is that who really cares? Who am I offending, and who is it that I'm trying not to turn off?
Right. Well, that's a decision that you have to make with your organization in, you know, with the messaging. And that's actually a very, very important point, is that, well, lots of things, right? Okay, so the very important point is that there is no theme or message unless, you know, there is no theme or media message unless there's a theme and organizational message, right? Okay. So whatever things that your organization hasn't talked about, right, and discussed and decided on, you can't frame a media message around it, right? Because it isn't there, right? Or you haven't been informed of it, or you haven't talked it out, right? So that's why preparing is so important. And this is the second point I wanted to make, is that when you pointed to your questions and you said, I had the same questions, I expected us to have the same questions, right? That's kind of a lesson, is that, in fact, it's an important lesson, is that usually you can anticipate the questions that you're going to be asked. Right? Because they're general information questions for the most part, right? Who is your organization? What do you do? Why do you think that it's important to do that? Right? What effect do you think it's having?
Okay.
These are the general form of, you know, the questions take. You know, if you don't know anything about something, right?
Right.
This is what you want to know, right? So these are the kinds of questions that you should have answers to, right? That your organization should have talking points or scripts around, right? Questions of general interest like this that anyone who's representing the organization might get asked at a particular time, right? The third point I wanted to make also about, and this comes up again in developing a media strategy, is for those tough questions, right? And for the tough deliveries, like you said, you were trying to decide, you know, how you were going to say what you were going to say, and even though you knew what you were going to say, it wasn't quite as smooth as you wanted it to be, although it did not seem unnaturally stumbling in any way, right? But I understand, right, as an interviewee, right?
Internal, right?
Yeah, your self-evaluation. But that requires practice, right? And it requires the practice of having done it, right, gone through it several times and tweaking your message and the way that you talk and are able to speak extemporaneously. And in order to get that kind of practice, it's important to have someone who it's their job or a major part of their job to interface with media, right? I don't think that in organizations, small organizations, you should have more than one or two people whose job it is, right, to interface with media. You know, especially with interviews. I don't mean to answer simple and basic questions, but in terms of interviews, there should be only one or two people who do that, just because it's easier, right, for someone who gets to practice doing it, right? You know, it's easier for them, right? They become better at it, clearer with the media. It's also logistically easier for media people, right, to know that they can contact only one person, right, or two people, or if someone from the media you know, outlet calls, you know who to refer them to, right? This is something that happens all the time with small arts and cultural organizations, is when you call, right, mm-hmm. as, you know, as whoever, but particularly, say, a reporter of some kind, and you say, well, I want to talk to someone about, you know, who, mm-hmm. what your organization does and who mm-hmm. they are and, you know, whatever. And the reporter will get the name of the person down and usually their information. But if they call back, they might be referred to someone else next time, right? Or if there are documents that need to be sent out, another person, in, you know, might do it. Now, with very small organizations, there might only be one or two people involved at all. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's that. But for sort of like smaller organizations that have volunteer staff or even a few paid staff, it's really important to focus and be able to channel that just through one or a couple of avenues. So those are basically the points that I wanted to make about the interview, is that, you know, it's normal that we should have the same questions, and I wanted to sort of do an exercise that would drive that point home.
I see.
Right? Mm-hmm. But in general, I think you did a great job of applying the steps that we had talked about before.
All right. Good afternoon, Ms. Ridley. I'm glad to see you this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. It's my understanding that your organization is going to hold a healing workshop in January 2006 in St. Lawrence. What does that mean, a healing our nation? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I think that pretty much anybody who has been privy to, you know, living in the United States over, you know, the span of our lives and even before that, understands that we're still dealing with issues of prejudice, segregation, and racism that have plagued the nation for a long time. And our organization feels that it's important to directly address those issues and take an active role in trying to heal our nation and overcome some of these divides.
Okay, I see. Well, in the past, what type of audience have you had, or what makes up the demographics of the workshop that you hold?
The attendees, or?
Yes, the attendees.
Well, the attendees are from a vast, you know, background. We try to include as many racial and ethnic populations as possible, because that's the point of the organization, right, is to get different people talking to each other about their difference and talking about how to negotiate around and with those differences and be engaged with each other, you know, through those differences.
Well, who are the people that facilitate these workshops? What are their qualifications?
Well, the people who facilitate the workshops are basically interested volunteers who have gone through trainings of their own, right? I mean, this is not necessarily rocket science. It's, you know, regular people who are, you know, interested in making a difference in their community. And part of what we want to do in the workshops is to train people to be able to talk about, you know, racial and ethnic difference and bring it home to their communities and talk to the people that they work with and play with and worship with, you know, in the same way that our facilitators do. Now, that said, our facilitators have gone through previous trainings to be able to have the tools and skill sets to convey, you know, information about how you deal with difference, right, when you have a multi-racial and multi-ethnic group of people that you want to interact with. But, you know, for the most part, they're just regular folk.
Well, what is the cost of this workshop? How do you set the fees? And is it accessible? Is it economically feasible that all of these different groups you have mentioned are able to come and engage or be involved?
Absolutely. I mean, it's free and open to the public, and we publicize in several different communities. Now, it hasn't always been, but this year we were fortunate enough to get a grant from the Ford Foundation, and we have stepped up our advertising in local and ethnic press around the neighborhoods, and also tried to do a lot of person-to-person recruitment and communication in, you know, neighborhood associations and churches and, you know, places where people come together.
Okay. How would you measure the success of your workshops?
Well, you know, we measure the success of our workshops in the kind of feedback and information we get from participants. And also sometimes from the people who haven't even been to our workshops, but have simply been around our participants, right? People who they work with, people in their neighborhood associations, people, you know, who they worship with, who they refer back to us. And, you know, that's the part that sort of really matters for the facilitators and the people doing the work.
Very good. Then will you be able to give me all of the information regarding the workshop in January so that we may list it?
Sure. I'll fax it to you.
Thank you.
Okay. How did I do?
I think you did great. I think you did great. Wow.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, I said, wow, she really catches on. It's like she's part of this organization.
No. Oh, no. Okay. So see, I don't know anything about actually what you guys do.
Right. Yeah.
So I can infer, obviously, mm-hmm. and I think mm-hmm. that the work that you do is important. But I don't have the data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That you know that you have, and I wouldn't know, right, mm-hmm. that you guys
or
do.
Where the facilitators come, because I thought that was important, because people say, "Well, who are you?"
Yeah. Yeah. Why are you talking? Yeah. I have no idea. Uh-huh. But but I think that. What's important to note, or what I tried to remember, right, is that you want to come across as, and be as, right, sort of, even though I didn't know the facts and the minutiae of what you guys do, mm-hmm. Is that I try to keep it as simple as possible, mm-hmm. right? I didn't make up that, you know, your facilitators are, you know, have PhDs in diversity training, or, like, I don't think there are PhDs in diversity training, although there may be, God knows. But they don't have to, right? They can be, mm-hmm. you know, regular mm-hmm. people who volunteer, and I can just tell you mm-hmm. that and tell you why that's the way we do it, mm-hmm. right? For, you know, the fictional version of your organization that I have imagined. You know, and just keep it clear and to the point and very sort of normal and not jargony and low-key, mm-hmm. you know? And of course, this is even better when you're actually representing an organization that you're a part of. Mm-hmm. But there are just a few sort of tricks of the trade in terms of being able to convey what you want to convey that can make you sound convincing, you know, even when, you know, even in a hypothetical situation like this one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Okay.
Great. So. That's the part about becoming a good interviewee. And it melds, as I said in the beginning, quite easily, right, is intertwined quite a lot with developing a media strategy or routine, right? This is really important. I can't emphasize it enough. And we do it in the last session of applying media resources because what we've been doing up until this point is putting tools in our toolbox, right? So how do you write a press release? We went over that, right?
Yes.
How do you make cold calls to reporters? We went over that. How do you become a good news consumer, right? Mm-hmm. We went over that. These are all sort of tools that you put in your media strategy toolbox, okay. right?
Yes.
And today we want to talk about, what we want to talk about is, how it is that you put all those tools in motion on a regular basis and some additional steps that you might want to take, okay? So again, to our handout step 5. Mm-hmm. Okay, so communicating with the media is not a one-time deal. Once you have gone to the trouble of consolidating a contact list, right, cold calling reporters, developing great press releases and giving great interviews, you don't want to throw all that work away and have to start from scratch each time around, right?
Okay.
This is particularly important for cultural and arts organizations that, for instance, have an annual event,
mm-hmm.
right? Not even the same event, but they just tend to do one or two events a year. You don't want to have to start from scratch every time,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, it burns a lot of man hours, right? And it's also just not as effective. You want to maintain the relationships that you have sort of started or seeded, okay? So instead, we want to work on developing a media strategy within our organizations, okay? And the first thing that has to be done, right, is determine the answer to the question, why do we want media coverage in the first place, right? Of what? For what? What do we want out of it? You know, what are our messages and themes going to be, right? Not just to the media, but around the event itself. So part of what has to be done before you even think about contacting media is to be very clear within your organization about what you're doing, right? And what you want to convey to the public, right?
Okay. Yes.
That has to happen first. There is no message. There are no themes, right? Media messages and themes, if there are not organizational method messages and themes. Okay. And the second thing that I think you want to do, right, in terms of questioning is determine the answer to the question, what do we want the public profile, right, of our organization or this event to be, right?
Okay.
Well, these are the kind of the basics, okay? These two questions will help you develop messages around specific events and stories, right, that will fit within the overall mission of your organization, okay, and make it easier for people who are representing your organization, right?
Okay.
They won't have to make anything up, right? It'll be simple and clear and already discussed and agreed on within the organization.
Okay.
The other side of that first step, right, that's more sort of externally focused, right? That's the internal part of it, and that has to happen inside the organization. But more externally focused is that you want to make sure that you have specific audiences selected, right, for your themes and messages. This is sort of applying the being good media consumers, right? And also have decided who you want to reach. In terms of like the question you asked me, what populations do you normally attend these workshops, right? What populations do you want to attend these workshops, right? Where do you have to be covered, right, in order for them to understand who you are and what you're doing, right?
Okay.
So that's what I mean about selecting specific audiences and trying to apply our knowledge from the being a good news consumer section of the workshop, okay? That's the first thing that's sort of externally focused. The second thing is that you want to very carefully select not only the audience, but the messengers, right? The messengers, okay? And this is also being a good news consumer. Know what journals you want to go to, right? To send out press releases to.
Right.
And beyond the level of sending out press releases, making those phone calls to, right? Like,
right.
You have a limited amount of time, and you might send out press releases very widely, right, but only make those phone calls to a few organizations, and you want to be clear about why you're making those phone calls to those organizations. You know, you don't want to go off the top of an alphabetical list or something like that, right? Okay, so moving on, what I mentioned before, make sure only one or two people are primarily responsible for communicating with the media. It makes things easier for everyone. It makes things easier for your organization and also for the people who are going to be contacting your organization.
Okay.
In
our organization, and I'll have to discuss that, you know, with the creator of the program. It's like I'm here in Chicago. The author of the program is in St. Louis. Then we have a gentleman in Dayton, Ohio. Then we have someone in Rockford. Then we have someone in Kalamazoo. Then we have a charter group in Arkansas. So it's important that Rita Starr, the director and the creator of the program, communicates this continuous message to all these different groups. You see what I mean? Because now we've got magazines and people. We've got Irene and Mimi who are in Kalamazoo, and they have
different publications that they use, mm-hmm. but the message has to be consistent because we are so spread out.
Mm-hmm.
Still, like you said earlier, that you know people read and make sure that you know you tell the truth and everything. The message has to continuously be consistent.
Consistency is so important,
and that's a lot of consistency. Because we are so spread out.
Mm-hmm. It means you guys have to be in regular communication with each other about these issues, not just about, you know, and it's very hard in a small organization, especially one as dispersed as yours seems to be,
mm-hmm.
To keep in contact about issues of themes, right, and messages when there's so much logistical stuff to keep in contact about. Well, you know how it goes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You call up the person in Kalamazoo to see what has to be delivered where and how to transfer resources from one place to another or to buy train tickets or plane tickets or, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I understand that, but that's what I mean about building into the process, that process, as hectic as it may be, a media strategy. And part of that media strategy is being in close communication with the other people in your organization about what your organization's themes are and how you want to develop messages around those themes,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it doesn't have to be a daily thing. It doesn't have to be weekly. It just has to be
mm-hmm.
regular,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Okay.
Yeah, and it's also a nice trick is to make each other aware of when you get covered in
right.
wherever you are,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To see how the, you know, so then everybody can see what gets put out there about the organization, and it's sort of a natural way to stay in touch about, oh, I liked this about this story, or I really liked what you said in the interview there, or
right.
if mm-hmm. you didn't, you know, if something happened where you don't like the coverage, to say, well, I didn't say that, they said that, you know what I'm saying? Like,
okay.
that's a nice, easy, sort of natural way to keep in contact about things like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so we already talked about identifying your audience,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And here's the other thing, and it seems like a big job at first, but it really helps, is to make a media calendar, right?
Yeah.
So when you plan events for the quarter or the year, right, if you happen to do things like that, I know that,
mm-hmm.
you know, small organizations especially, it's not always easy to plan everything so far in advance. But if you do,
mm-hmm.
You should also plan when you want to announce those events to the press.
Okay.
That should be a part of planning the event. Right?
Okay.
So when you think of having a workshop or a conference or an art opening or releasing a book or
mm-hmm.
whatever, part of that plan has to be not only, all right, what building are we going to have it in? Which
mm-hmm.
speakers are we going to have? How are we going to pay the artists? You know, also a part of those kinds of questions should be, when are we going to send out the press releases? Do we have a list of the people we're going to call? When are those calls going to get made? When are we going to follow up with those stories? Like, you know, that has to be sort of a part of the plan. So when you're making an organizational calendar,
mm-hmm.
Anyway, just be sure to include the media in that plan, right?
Mm.
Because a lot of the things that we have been talking about are all about sort of scheduling and being
mm-hmm.
organized and sort of knowing when your events are going to happen, having time to talk about what you want to convey about those events, you know, and having time to follow through and follow up.
Okay.
And that is, I think, part of the heart of developing a media routine. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about strategies and tools. Like, we've talked about tools, right, in terms of skill sets to develop through practice, like techniques for being a good interviewee, right,
mm-hmm.
techniques for being a good news consumer, techniques for, you know, being able to cold call, you know, reporters that you have never met before. Like, we've talked about those sort of techniques, right?
Right.
But it's also really important to develop a routine so that you can employ those techniques on a regular basis.
And if you do that, it's almost like whoever you're communicating with will be saying, almost calling you saying, oh, well, I haven't heard from you in 3 months. Isn't it time for another workshop something?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because that relationship that you make with the person that you speak with.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's a really huge part of it, is just making it a part of what you regularly do, right? People feel that interacting with media, right, and being able to use media as a resource is this big job that only specialists can do.
Yeah.
And it's really not, right? You don't have to be a specialist. You just need some tips, some practice, and a regular routine,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's basically the way that I want to end this session, is to sort of drive that point home, is to say, mm-hmm. you know, the biggest part of this is setting up a space in your organization where you can employ the tools that we have talked about up until this point, and the best way to do that is to develop a regular routine. And the easiest way to do that is to build in, you know, media work along with all the rest of your regular work,
mm-hmm.
right? And then it becomes, you know, a part of, you know, we've got to find the building, we've got to find the speakers, we've
mm-hmm.
got all the logistics
mm-hmm.
that anyone has to deal
mm-hmm.
with anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's neat.
It is.
You see, I'm so thrilled. Oh, I could have had more people. Oh, okay.
Yeah.